essential in every ecosystem. For example, many of the world's crops and other plants rely on insects for pollination. In forests, insects help break down dead trees and prepare the soil for new growth. And there are the animals like birds and bats that feed on insects. So how exactly will global warming affect insects? We don't really know. Some may go extinct. Others could migrate to cooler regions and wipe out native insect species there. And this could have all sorts of important implications for crops and entire ecosystems. What we do know is that because insects can't regulate their body temperature to the same degree as mammals, they're particularly sensitive to climate change. It's hard to predict what will happen to insects as the Earth warms, but it looks like we're about to find out. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear, with help from Larry Murdoch at Purdue University. There are hundreds more Moments of Science on our website at amomentofscience.org. I'm Don Glass.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
In sports, Philadelphia can close out its best-of-five divisional playoff series with Colorado tonight. The Phillies took a 2-1 lead last night with a 6-5 win in Denver. The American League Championship Series will start this Friday night in New York. The Yankees, who eliminated Minnesota over the weekend, will face the LA Angels. Los Angeles advanced with a 3-game sweep of Boston. The Monday night NFL game is taking place tonight in Miami as the Dolphins entertain the Jets. New York enters the game in first place in the AFC East with a 3-1 record, while the defending division champion Dolphins are 1-3. And the weekly AP Top 25 poll came out yesterday. The Florida Gators remained the top team in college football. The Gators are followed by Alabama, Texas, Virginia Tech, and Boise State. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: SuperValue, Champaign, SuperValue, Minneapolis, and Swires Land and Management Company, Danville. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 2:43. This is the Afternoon Magazine. In his latest letter from India, NPR's Philip Reeves examines a debate. It's about the capital, Delhi, and how people there behave. The source of worry is how the capital will look to outsiders when a huge athletic extravaganza is held there in less than a year.
The people of India can be a little touchy sometimes. They generally don't take kindly to being criticized by outsiders. Who does? But they're very happy to criticize themselves. At the moment, they're doing so with unusual gusto. The targets of their criticism are the inhabitants of their own capital, New Delhi, millions of souls, now being characterized as the rudest and most boorish people in the country, if not on earth. India's commentators have been competing to find words that capture the full horror of the capital's failings. Delhiites have been called aggressive and vulgar, arrogant and ill-tempered. Newspapers have printed lists of examples of their uncouth conduct, including atrocious driving, spitting, urinating in public, and speaking too loudly on cell phones. Rudeness is in Delhi's DNA, India's Mail Today bitterly declared the other day. This bout of national introspection is taking place for a reason. In just under 1 year, New Delhi is to stage the Commonwealth Games. Thousands of athletes will arrive from dozens of countries, mostly formerly part of the British Empire. With them will come hordes of officials, journalists, sports fans, and hangers-on. Everyone here is worried that New Delhi won't be ready in time. You only have to take a short drive through town to see their point. Every other road seems to be dug up to make way for new drains or flyovers or metro stations. There are potholes, traffic jams, stray animals, and sometimes giant puddles of water. The authorities are reassuring everyone that everything will be okay in the end. They're organizing etiquette courses for New Delhi's notoriously grumpy rickshaw drivers. That hasn't stopped people worrying that even if New Delhi is ready, its citizens won't behave properly when the guests arrive. For an outsider like me, this is all a little mystifying. I've been asking Indian friends why the people of New Delhi are seen as so obnoxious. Aren't there lots of capitals whose residents drive like maniacs and talk too loudly on cell phones? Isn't it unfair to blame Delhi's men for urinating in the streets when there are far too few public amenities? Aren't most of these criticisms, in fact, coming from the affluent middle class and are aimed at the city's multitude of migrant poor? What about the artists and intellectuals? Are they uncouth too? My questions have been brushed aside. You don't understand because you are a foreigner, said one friend, sounding distinctly irritated. You've no idea what people are really like. As I said, Indians can be a little touchy sometimes, even when you're not criticising them. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Hundreds of people turned out in Baltimore yesterday to pay their respects to a famous author. The author is Edgar Allan Poe. He died in 1849. This year is the bicentennial of his birth, which is being celebrated in various ways around the country. And why not give the man known for The Raven and The Telltale Heart a grand funeral? When Poe died, he was penniless, and so few people came to his funeral, the minister dispensed with the sermon. NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
They came in droves, lining the streets in front of Baltimore's red brick Westminster Hall. Crowds watched a group of men playing bagpipes precede an historic horse-drawn hearse. It bore a reddish-brown pine casket containing an eerily realistic-looking replica of Poe's body. Mourners came from as far away as London for the service. Others, like Regan Mercer, were local. She's mad for the master of the macabre.
I sort of grew up on Poe.
Mercer was decked out in period attire, complete with an iridescent green Victorian hat with a peacock feather, an antique black dress, ankle boots, and an elaborate coat with lace-up detail.
Because if you're going to go to Poe's funeral hundreds of years later, seems like the kind of thing you want to dress up for.
And dress up many did, including the actors who played the roles of Poe's friends. Some spoke at the ceremony, including Poe's one-time fiancée, Sarah Helen Whitman.
No portrait of Poe does justice to the unmatched glory of his face. Capturing his subtle moods was impossible. And his voice? He had no equal as a conversationalist.
He was little more than a carping grammarian.
Even one of Poe's detractors, the Reverend Rufus Griswold, showed up to savage the dead, earning glares and hisses throughout the rest of the program.
Mr. Griswold, you are quite finished.
But
please,
sir,
return to your seat.
Touch upon his more recent life.
Return to your seat.
But admirers and fellow artists, from master horror writer H.P. Lovecraft to Alfred Hitchcock, available perhaps by time travel or more nefarious devices, spoke of Poe's genius and humanity. Actor Mark Redfield, the actual person, spoke of how deeply Poe's work is embedded in our culture.
On stage, there are operas, ballets, musicals, one-man shows, puppet shows, street performers, radio plays, records, CDs, MP3s. Poe lives, and in technologies not yet known, Poe will live on.
Once upon a midnight dreary,
while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious
volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping.
From The Simpsons to the late Vincent Price, Poe's words thread a dark, twisted path through literature. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, or his spirit, reminded the mourners that it is Poe they must thank, not only for his Sherlock Holmes, but for modern-day detectives like Monk. Where else but Poe, wondered Lovecraft, would other horror scribes gain their inspiration?
If I have ever been able to approximate his kind of thrill, it is only because he himself paved the way by creating a whole atmosphere and method which lesser men can follow with relative ease.
Poe died mysteriously after he was found delirious outside of a bar. Organizers of the event say he had more than made up for the paltry farewell offered the writer in October of 1849. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
It's 2:50. In the pop music business, very few singles become hit songs, but musicians can now use a computer program to hone in on what they think you'll like. The software is produced by a company called Music Intelligence Solutions. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Many of us like to believe that there's a little magic behind the making of a hit single. Take a song like I Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas. I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. And that's a good song, judging by sales. It's top of the Billboard pop chart. David Meredith, CEO of Music Intelligence Solutions, says there's no magic in that. It's math. He says software gave the song a hit score of 8.9 out of 10. It's called Hit Song Science,
which are a series of algorithms that we use to look at what's the potential of a song to be sticky with a listener, to have those patterns in the music that would correspond with what human brainwaves would find pleasing.
Meredith says his software found that hits have certain common patterns of rhythm, harmony, chord progression, length, lyrics. A study done by the Harvard Business School claimed the software was accurate 8 out of 10 times. This summer, Music Intelligence launched a website for songwriters called Youplaya. David Bell, part of the hip-hop duo The Block Scholars, paid $90 to use it.
It's an unbiased validation of your music. You know, it's not your family turning around and telling you, oh, you got a great song.
The computer told Bell he had a 7.1. Good, but not great. So he went back to the studio and remixed.
Hold your head up, man. Yo, yo, yo. This is for my people all around the world trying to get what they deserve. You don't need no haters in your circle, so kick them to the curb.
He got his score to 7.6. That's platinum. He could hold his head up.
We can use Youplaya as a tool to figure out what songs we want to put in a demo to send to these labels and stuff.
From an artist standpoint, a songwriter standpoint, it's horrifying to me.
That's independent singer-songwriter Kim Tuvim. Tuvim can't stand the star-making machine behind the popular song. She hates the idea of artists trying to fit their songs into algorithms.
You'll find a decreasing amount of any kind of surprises in music. This just becomes a tool to make that narrowing of the field more accessible.
Tuvim says her songs come from a mysterious place in her unconscious.
There ain't no lifeboat can float us away from him. There ain't no lifeboat can float us away from here.
Tuvim might not love the computer, but the computer loves her song Flood. It got a 7.3, that's platinum. It doesn't surprise New Yorker music critic Sasha Frere Jones that a computer can predict hits, but he doesn't think it can predict all the hits. Thank goodness, he says. Sometimes songs come along that don't fit the mold.
I think of a song like Da 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 by Trio, which people love. They just love that song. And I can't imagine that at the time in 80, 81, that the software would have given that a very high rating. It was sonically very small. It sounded like a kid's song. They might have told the band, no, 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 beef it up.
The software still doesn't think it's a hit. Da 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 got a 6. Jones worries if hit song science played too big a role in the music industry, a lot of good songs would never see the light of day. Music Intelligence Solutions CEO Meredith calls his software a democratizing force in music, a sort of computerized American Idol. If an unknown, unconnected artist gets a high score, then his company will help promote them with record labels.
We'll shine a spotlight on you, you'll get recognized, and we'll get the word out. And that's probably a good way for the industry to work relative to it being who do you know. It's more about what kind of talent level that you have.
Meredith also points out that his software isn't writing the songs. Human beings do that, at least for now. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
When is a marriage not a marriage? Sometimes the answer has to do with how closely rules are followed, including the filing of a marriage license. Here's commentator Amy Guida with this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
There's a picture on a newspaper's website of a loving Pennsylvania couple holding tight to the chains on their porch swing. The two have been married for almost 50 years, and both are laughing as if they've just heard the funniest joke ever. And they sort of have. Turns out that they may not be married after all. Here's the problem. The priest who married them in 1960 never filed the couple's marriage license at the county courthouse. Not having that little piece of paper on file with the government? Boy, that's bad, the county records person explained to the newspaper. That does cause a big problem. It may be a big bad problem, but it's one that has happened before. And as it turns out, the law often does what you'd hope it would do in such a situation. It pretends that that little piece of paper was filed as required. It's all in the public interest, most courts figure. The law generally upholds a marriage, especially when there are highly interested family members, like offspring of the union, involved. Take a case from Connecticut decided in 1980 that parallels in some ways the recent Pennsylvania situation. There, it was a priest who'd failed to register the license. There, the couple had four children and held themselves out to be married for many years. But here's the difference. When the husband wanted a divorce, he claimed that he didn't need one after all because, he argued, since there was no license on file, there was no valid marriage. But the court sided with the wife. The policy of the law, the court wrote, is strongly opposed to regarding an attempted marriage entered into in good faith, believed by one or both of the parties to be legal, and followed by cohabitation, to be void. But recall that I said that the law often does what you'd hope it would do? That's because the laws of all states are not as forgiving. In some states, judges worry that playing fast and loose with the requirements for a marriage license will leave the public in the dark about who is actually married. Look the other way on the marriage license front, they worry, and pretty soon people will be married with a wink and a nod, including some who don't wish to be. Much depends upon the fact pattern at the heart of the case, of course. If there are facts that seem to indicate that maybe one of the parties didn't intend to get married after all, then the lack of a marriage license might indeed be evidence of the lack of a marriage itself. That means that when a couple divorced and then supposedly participated in a remarriage ceremony, the court weighed more heavily the fact that there seemed to be a conscious effort on the part of the husband not to get a marriage license the second time around. Sadly, that meant that the putative wife didn't get benefits that a licensed wife would have. But courts in most states facing couples like the one on the Pennsylvania porch swing are likely to work hard to uphold their decades-long union, license or not. Keep on swinging, the courts would tell them. On the porch swing, that is. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Well, I'd like to see the United States go back to exploration of the planets with human beings.
You're listening to planetary scientist Alan Stern. He's principal investigator of an ongoing NASA mission called New Horizons that launched an unmanned spacecraft to explore Pluto. Dr. Stern told Earth Sky he believes in sending humans, not just robots, to explore the moon and other planets.
Human beings are much more efficient than the robots. Now, the robots can go much farther afield. The robots.